Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. The culture critic and novelist Lauren Euler is no stranger to causing a stir. Her essays and reviews are often found on the websites of publications The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The London Review of Books. Occasionally, her acerbic literary criticism has whipped up such a storm that it's temporarily taken down the site on which it's residing. In 2021, Euler published a novel, Fake Accounts, which follows the aftermath of a young woman discovering her boyfriend is leading a double life as an anonymous internet conspiracy theorist. Now, Euler is back with a work of non-fiction, a new book of essays entitled No Judgment. In her trademark arch voice, Euler muses on gossip and Goodreads, expat life in Berlin, and her experience trying jaw yoga to ease her own anxiety-fueled teeth grinding. Her take on the world is thoughtful, discursive, often very funny. It encourages the reader to think about all manner of things, art, the internet, migration, in a new light. I was delighted to discuss the book in our studios at Midori House. Stay tuned for my conversation with Lauren Euler. And Lauren joins us now. Lauren, wonderful to have you on the programme. Congratulations on No Judgment. And I want to go straight in and talk about something that you address in kind of every chapter. And it's one of your, I guess, major themes. And that is, quote unquote, the drama of opinion, which I love. And I love so many of the things you bring up in this book. I think we're on many of the same sides. But tell our listeners a little bit about what you mean and how you fight in the trenches of the drama of opinion.
Sure. Thank you for having me. The drama of opinion is actually a quote by the American literary critic Elizabeth Hardwick, mm-hmm. who helped start the New York Review of Books. And the phrase comes up in my essay, My Perfect Opinions, which is about the website review platform Goodreads, as well as professional criticism, elitism, populism in the arts and culture. And basically, this phrase, the drama of opinion, comes up in this Elizabeth Hardwick essay called The Decline of Book Reviewing, which mm-hmm. was published in, I believe, 1959.
And they were having a hard time even then.
We've been having a hard time.
It was ever thus. Yeah.
They started doing book reviews and they were like, this was a bad idea. They used to be better.
when they were 10,000 words long, when they were a tenth of the book they were reviewing.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So basically the point I'm making is that people have always said book reviews are sort of declining. They're not as good as they used to be. The book reviewers care much more about content and plot and about the sort of personality of the author rather than both assessing and producing a good style. Mm-hmm. And another thing that Elizabeth Hardwick says is that her contemporary reviewers shy away from the drama of opinion. Now, today, our problems are rather different.
But nonetheless manifold.
We live in a sort of an attention economy online where the drama of opinion sort of is all that there is, right? You're really encouraged to have like the strongest possible opinion that you can have and to explain it in the most sort of radical, unassailable terms, which tend to have to do with your identity, right? So, So the ultimate point of this essay, not to give it away, is that the mode of opinion sharing online is sort of dissatisfying because no one can ever be wrong and then therefore no one can also ever be right. And it's just a real mess, which is why it takes me 17,000 words to get there. But hopefully I do. And I think too, you know,
this is in my perfect opinions. Which is, as many of your titles for your essays are, something like fighting talk anyway.
I like to create drama, but not necessarily by not saying the sort of strongest, most forceful opinion, but saying it in the most sort of incisive or provocative way, right? Saying what I think in the most incisive or provocative way. I care a little bit too much about being honest and being frank. This also gets me in trouble in my relationships, but I don't know if I've ever been wrong in the end. I'm always sort of proven right. Sometimes you just have to have patience for people to agree with you. But, you know, I believe in actually entertaining the reader in a sustained way, not in sort of shocking them the way that, you know, someone on the internet might, you know, post something really crazy and like say what's a dramatic opinion that would also would not be offensive for me to say on Monocle Radio.
It's fine. We're not the BBC. You can kind of do anything.
Cats
here
are better than whatever. Like, yeah. I can't think of a dramatic opinion right now. But you could say a really dramatic opinion, or you could say something that you think is true, but in a really saucy way, right? With irony.
Yeah.
And if you deploy irony, obviously, a lot of people don't understand it, and then they get mad because they think you're totally serious, and then you're trying to explain yourself, and then they think you're lying.
Do you find the way that you express yourself and the archness with which you're able to changes from territory to territory, readership to readership? Because you have produced a book that is full of, it is collective criticism, but it's been, some of it is, it's fresh stuff. So you've got a different audience for this book. People are going into bookstores to buy it on purpose rather than happening across it on the comments section of the internet. You're clearly way beyond that. So you're in a different position, I suppose, authorially and in reality.
Yeah, and I think sort of the topics of these essays are much broader. They're very general. Sort of, I wanted to write an essay about gossip, right? Very broad topic. It's not, you know, I want to review a book about gossip and then sneak in a couple of ideas that I have of my own, right? I want to say like, okay, I want to write about gossip because I think it's important, because I think something is happening in the media that relates to gossip, right? And so then I have to figure out what that is and what I'm going to say and what is my argument going to be about gossip. And that process looks a lot different than being assigned to write a little 2,000-word essay by a magazine.
And to go back to Elizabeth Hardwick, the gossip columns of the 1950s, not the book reviews pages, the New York Times, whatever it might be, the gossip columns were an official and much-loved page or column, I suppose that's where the phrase comes from, in august newspapers themselves, right? So the nature of gossip and the mediated nature of gossip, I suppose, has changed just as much as serious criticism.
Right. Well, and I think, too, what you're talking about, this sort of classic gossip column or the gossip magazine, right, which we all know, it used to be sort of cordoned off. It used to be like, this is the gossip area. This is what we're doing.
The unsafe space.
This is the unsafe space. And I'm interested in gossip as a sort of media technology almost, because when you say this is gossip, what is the message that you're sending, right? The message that you're sending is, this is a story that is probably or partially true. There are certain elements of this story that can be verified, but it has not been verified, right? So it is placing the ambiguity of the truth claim onto the receiver of the message rather than the sender. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, you know, if I say, I heard she was having an affair, right? That's a truthful statement because I could have heard that. But immediately your response is going to think she is having an affair. And unless you have a sort of rigorous fact-checking apparatus in your mind, you might just say to your friend, she's having an affair, right? Yeah. I heard that from Lauren. and, you know, that's used to be sort of what the gossip column was. And this essay that we're talking about gossip is kind of a sort of recent media history of the last 25 years or so. I'm a lot about digital media. And
includes Gawker. And
yeah, it
stuff.
Talks a lot about Gawker. And Gawker was this sort of, I think, you know, a trailblazer in changing the way that we understand news and reporting. If you're not familiar with their amazing tagline, it was, today's gossip is tomorrow's news. I sort of chart...
A sort of nostalgic Proustian feeling just hearing that.
Yeah, I know.
You're spoken like, out loud.
You know, I remember when I read... I remember reading the comment section of Jezebel when I was in university, like in one of the big lecture classes that you had your computer out. And now it's all gone. But, you know, you go from Gawker to Donald Trump and fake news and also Me Too. Gossip played a big role in the Me Too movement as well, because the whole concept of the whisper network is based on the idea that gossip is a powerful tool, right? And so there was this sort of, for many years, there was a sense like gossip actually can be good. It's a very powerful tool.
You mentioned the Me Too movement, how it sort of became... You describe it as a feminist argument towards gossip.
And the feminist argument for gossip is basically that marginalized people use gossip to share information and protect themselves against the powerful in whatever form that takes, right? And this is a very common academic argument in the 70s and 80s in the feminist movement that was sort of reheated by the Me Too movement in order to take down these big predators, as they called them, right? But obviously, gossip, you know, you say this a lot. You say, oh, it's, you know, gossip is a feminist tool. It's a feminist movement. You know, it's really good. And you sort of forget that there are drawbacks to it. And it, that sort of sense of ambiguity and sort of putting the onus on the audience to interpret information in good faith. It's a difficult proposition, especially in this sort of media environment that we were just talking about, where everybody wants to have a very dramatic opinion. Everyone wants to get attention by being like the most dramatic that they can be, right? Everybody wants someone else's life to be ruined and for them to be the person that tells you about it. And so I sort of relate that to the rise of like fake news, the concept of fake news in the during the Trump administration in the United States, through which basically trust in the media tanked. It was falling over the course of the 2000s and 2010s. And now it's just horrible. Nobody trusts the media. And my argument in that essay is basically that everybody sort of reads the news almost as if it's gossip, right? And that's not to say that the New York Times is just full of gossip. It's a gossip rag. They're lying. I don't actually think that. But I do think that there's sort of broader news and media awareness such that they understand that reporting can be biased. And so everybody sort of takes what would have once have been considered reliable sources and thinks of them as, you know, incomplete, right?
Yeah.
In the same way that we
listen to gossip. The pinch of salt and everything, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might have a really reliable friend, someone like me, whose gossip often proves to be true.
You just told me she was having an affair.
Yeah, exactly. She
okay.
is having an affair.
Okay.
And in 2 years, you'll come to me and you'll be like, you were totally right. And I doubted you on the radio. Or you may have someone who's like completely unreliable and they tell you something and you're like, oh, of course. She's always saying stuff like that, but it never comes to fruition. And the same is true with magazines and newspapers and things like that.
Your subject matters, they share some things in common. And that thing, if I may say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the sort of mediated state of the having of opinions, period, and the writing down and publishing of those opinions, I suppose. And I wonder if you've considered, I sense reading the book and watching some of your YouTube interviews, that you will have thought about this, not just how it will be received, but how people will be reading your book, your collection of essays in one hand, and kind of looking things up with their left hand, as it were.
I didn't necessarily intend this starting out, but as I was working on the essays, a lot of them ended up being sort of very recent histories. Mm-hmm. This gossip essay we were just talking about, and also the Berlin essay and the sort of recent history of expatriate involvement in Berlin, if not necessarily life in Berlin, because a lot of them don't tend to stay very long.
Yeah.
And autofiction as well, right? So I'm not an academic, I'm not a historian, so I don't purport to do sort of real deep history. There is a sort of book that has been written and could be written again about the history of the expat in Berlin, Germany. But I'm much more interested in sort of using the history that I know and that I sort of have access to researching in order to illuminate sort of tensions or problems that I have observed today, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that involves going like way, way back. And sometimes that involves, you know, having a vague memory of some blog post that you read in 2007 and then going back to that blog post and saying like, oh, it's actually different than I remember. And then you thought, you know, this is the great thing about the internet, right? It gets a bad rap, but it's a great research tool.
And it's mostly all still there.
Yeah, and sort of creating a narrative about histories, creating a historical narrative or creating a story about the recent past is not something that a lot of people can or even want to do. And a lot of people really reject that as a critical focus, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure everybody hates being alive now. Everyone, you know, thinks everything used to be better in the past. Everyone suffers from extreme nostalgia. We all hate our cell phones. We all think I think a lot of people sort of operate under the assumption that the internet will go away at any minute, right? Like it can't possibly be.
It's just a blip, right?
It can't possibly be that this is the historical moment that we're living in. So to sort of contextualize the present moment and say, oh, look, here's how we got here, which is what I think I do in a lot of these pieces, it can be a little bit like you just worry you're not going to be taken seriously, right? And my argument is that, you know, this stuff is serious. We're all alive now. This is the authentic moment that we're living in. You need to accept the reality that...
It's near history. You're giving us near history.
It's not Weimar, you know? And they had their problems in Weimar. Like, it wasn't just a walk in the park. And also, I think if you read novels from any other period of time from now, or, you know, you read nonfiction from, again, or history books or anything, you see that the things that we say about the present moment, that everything is worse than ever before, to bring it back to the decline of book reviewing, for example, when you start reading more broadly or more historically, you sort of see that people have always been, you know, uniquely apocalyptically minded about whatever it is that they care about, whether it's book reviews or our attention spans or like life itself, right? You know, everyone always thinks the world is about to end. Nevertheless, sometimes people do, you know, people, I'm always shocked by this, but I do still get people saying, you know, why you shouldn't be writing about the internet. Why are you writing about social media? I'm like, the internet has been around since the 1970s. And you can really trace it much farther back than that. You can trace it kind of back to the 40s. So it's not new, right? Why are you writing about social media? And it's, you know, because it's what I'm working with. I work with what I have, right? I'm not an idealist. I'm a realist, unfortunately.
Because as we said at the beginning, so much of your work is about being mediated. It is work that exists. It's not that it couldn't exist without the mediation, but it exists in a freshly mediated online world. And you stress that a lot of the time in your subject matter and your breaking of the fourth wall, sometimes often to the reader, I guess. Do you think the internet and the way we use it, social media and what have you, do you think it assages a human thirst for it, or whether we brought it into being so that we could do this exact thing with it, I wonder.
Absolutely.
While I have you here, I mean, yeah, like, I've got to ask you that.
Sure. What is human nature? Yeah, of course. I mean, everybody wants to know more. I think a lot of these essays, if you don't want to say they're about mediation, they're about awareness, right? And so the internet it has sort of made exponential the amount of awareness you can acquire. If that's a super weird sentence, but you know. It's just made it possible for you to have so much awareness both of yourself and how you are perceived by other people, and also potentially of, you know, everyone else. You can also look up any word that you don't know in a book. You can look anything up. What's amazing to me is that people don't, right? Actually, there's a lot of possible, you know, possibilities for knowledge that people don't take.
Do you think, you kind of alluded to that idea, if there's a word someone doesn't get immediately, or they don't get the irony of the way in which it's used in a comment, in an article, short or long, online, people would rather be angry about it than simply that. It's much quicker to do that than to take down your OED from a dusty bookshelf, right?
Absolutely.
And yet people don't do that.
It's not about learning. It's about wanting to have always known, right?
Yeah.
And so if you think of your technology, your cell phone, as an extension of yourself, right, you theoretically could know. There's actually something amazing in one of the Knausgård, in one of the My Struggle books, where he says, you know, I didn't actually know this, but I could have known it, so therefore I felt like I knew it, right? And this is the condition of having your computer phone on you at all times, right? Sometimes you'll be at, I'm sure you do this, sometimes you'll be at the bar and you and your friends are trying to remember a fact or something, or trying to remember the name of someone.
Everyone tries to hold out.
Yes. And nobody, you know, you could all look it up and everyone's like, no, don't look it up.
Yeah. I'm going to get it. I know who it is.
Exactly. And so I think there is the state of being mediated is also the state of constantly being aware that you are mediated and trying to sort of resist it, or sort of hold out your kind of like the illusion of a true self that is not mediated, but actually, of course, you're always, I'm not going to say always already mediated, but you know, you are, right?
Like, you give the sense a lot, often in your essays, of a generation, and I think it is generational, who are increasingly behaving as if they're like there's a mirror in front of them, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that comes across in a lot of the essays. You yourself aren't immune to it, and you address this in one of the chapters near the end of the book as well. I wonder if we talked about kind of people leaving shitty reviews on Goodreads, or not quite good enough reviews to get them up to the points, sort of the top of the Premier League kind of thing, on Goodreads. Do you think there's a problem with honesty and people being definitive, actually, online, that we, in terms of criticism, literary criticism, film criticism, there are a lot of punches pulled, I think, in newspapers, in magazines, in online publications. There's not a lot of people saying really what they mean about things. Learned people who are being too polite, I always think.
Well, I think you have this, I think you have learned people being too polite, so they're pulling their punches because they, somebody asked me the other day, you know, why is it that the people whose opinion you want most on things, like, often aren't giving their opinions all the time on social media? Why is it that all these annoying people are on social media giving their opinions 24/7? And it's like the smart people aren't doing that. And I was like, well, you've answered your question, right? The learned people are quite careful about what they say because they don't want to be wrong. And then when they do express an opinion, it's sort of more nuanced and more likely to approach correctness. And I talk about this in the book, but there's, if we're talking about literature specifically or cultural viewers more broadly, they have more to lose by being wrong and more to lose sort of by sticking their necks out, or they at least think that they do, right? And this is the awareness problem where it's like they're like, oh, I don't want to be seen. People are constantly constructing, like, overly precious about constructing their public persona, and they don't really realize that people are going to say all sorts of things about them no matter what they do. So you might as well just be honest or do what you say what you want to say, because someone is always going to despise you unreasonably for it, or reasonably, as the case may be. And then an opposite problem is people think that people are being really honest, but they're deeply misinformed.
Yeah.
And you can't really like argue with them. You can't really argue with them, because people don't really want to be, as we just discussed, people get mad if you use a word that they don't know when they can just look it up. They don't really want to be corrected.
Yeah. But I mean, specifically in the realm of criticism, people kind of, there have been columns about this recently, about the fact that people do pull their punches, not because they are fearful of being wrong, but fearful of their correctness, objective, as subjective as it may be, being considered, it's not the right thing to do. You can't put, someone spent 2 years writing that book, and even if it's not as good as their last one, you can't possibly say that.
You might hurt their feelings,
right?
It's about their feelings, right?
That's not why we buy magazines, is it? That's not why we buy books.
Well,
and that's not why we buy magazines to review them, is it?
Of course. Well, I do think that a lot of, well, no, I don't really think that the problems in the media or journalism as an industry, right, or as a dying industry, could be solved by culture critics being more exciting. But I think it would help cultural criticism be more robust, and maybe it would help, like, a little bit, you know. And it would certainly get more people interested in culture as well as cultural criticism. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know. I mean, maybe if people were having viral book reviews every single week, right? Like, if the magazines were, if it was just a war of book reviews all the time, people would get in on it and enjoy it. But so much of the discussion around the potential decline of book reviewing now is about whether the book reviews should be covering mainstream popular genre fiction that is much more popular than literary fiction or literary criticism, but which is not necessarily the most interesting work to write or think about, right?
It's not what the reviewers perhaps do themselves or wish they were doing, or it's not the chattering classes idea.
Yeah, but also, you know, it's doing just fine without that, right? There's a whole sort of robust kind of media that serves genre work and sort of popular media. You know, there's so many blogs dedicated to Taylor Swift. You don't really need to write about Taylor Swift that often because, you know, she already she's doing great. And what these people want is to have their cake and eat it too, right? They want to have the easier cultural option, but they also want to have the institutional imprimatur of the New York Times serving them reviews, right? It's like the customer is always right. Like, why isn't the New York Times giving me more Taylor Swift content? Because I deserve it, right? And people really, really bristle at the idea of like an institution and an institution gatekeeping, right, was a very popular word a couple of years ago. Things like that.
I just have one last idea for you, and that is, have you heard of Nikki Haslam? He's a sort of aristocratic British interior designer and snob. Oh. And he used to have a column in the Evening Standard when it was a newspaper of some note. Mm. And his column was simply called How Common. And he would list, say, three things a week that were common, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And one of the last ones I remember was feedback. And I felt I wanted to present this nugget to you because I felt that you would kind of understand that. I think you have a very sensitive bullshit kind of meter, and your idea of vulnerability and TED Talks being banal and, you know, the plain obvious being a hack, mm-hmm. a life hack and all the rest of it. Where does the notion of feedback sit? I mean, I don't mean in terms of reviews of things generally, reviews of your book in particular, but this is a hell of a lot of it, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
And you could just say it is literally common.
It is literally common, and people always want to be the one to give feedback, right?
Yeah.
But I worked with someone who used to sort of ostentatiously pride themselves on loving feedback, and they just can't get enough of it, and they think it's so great because they're sort of performing humility with that, right? They're like, I can take it, and I think everybody has something useful for me to say because I can always learn and grow, right? And that is this sort of a very common. Just to be clear, I grew up working class, so I can say common, however I choose. You know, I think it's very common defensive posture to say, oh, I welcome feedback. I love edits, right? In the literary world, people will just be fawning all over the concept of edits, and anything an editor does is obviously always right. And I distrust anybody who says, you know, who generalizes in that way, right? If you were to ask me how I feel about feedback, I'd say, well, it depends. Who's giving it? What's their track record? And, like, does it sound right to me, right? I think there's such a distrust of the self, one's own. There's such a distrust of one's own narrative. And this is also sort of about the sort of therapy culture, right? And sort of the vogue now for psychoanalysis, the idea that you can never know yourself and you need other people to observe you. Of course, it's true in some ways and also some ways not. And this is very dissatisfying, not a great soundbite answer. But ultimately, like, the truth about it is, like, it really depends on who you are and who's talking to you, right? If that makes sense at all.
Indeed. No judgment. Congratulations on it.
Thanks,
Laura Neuner. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. And that is it for this week. My thanks to Lauren Euler, and No Judgment is out now, published by Virago. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thank you for tuning in.